everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass, and it's time for It's All About Food. It's All About Food. How long can you go without food? That's how important it is. I know I've spoken about fasts before. It just came to my mind. How long can you go without food? I know that I can go at least 3 weeks without food because I did a 3-week water-only fast probably about 15 years ago or so. And it was a fascinating experience. But I'm not saying that we should go without food. Unfortunately, there are many people who do go without food, and they're not doing it for any intentional reason. They're hungry, and there are many people who get very little food. And we talk a lot about food on this program. I love talking about delicious food, healthy food, and I know that I'm very fortunate and privileged to have access to an abundance of healthy, delicious food, and I know that there are many that don't. I'm aware of that when I encourage you to eat healthy, delicious food and to enjoy the recipes that we put together at responsibleeatingandliving.com. But I always keep in mind that there are those that don't have this privilege. And it's always fascinating to think every time we sit down to eat, and I know most of us don't do this and I don't do it enough, to really think about where our food comes from. And it's a fascinating journey to take. And I repeat suggesting to go through this because it's something that we can easily take for granted, and it's fascinating. So, hello, Jonathan, are you there?
Hi, yes, I'm here.
Yes.
My computer's being a bit slow, but hopefully you'll be able to actually see me in a second.
Great. Oh, no, we don't have to see. This is all audio.
Okay.
Yes, and so you're connected to Progressive Radio.
Okay.
I'm assuming that's how we're connecting.
Well, it seems so.
Yes, good. So I'm glad that I got you. I was just talking while waiting for you, and I need to give you the appropriate introduction. How important it is to think about where our food comes from. And it's so easy to take for granted when we have access to healthy, delicious food all the time, for those of us who do, to not realize the long chain, the long journey, all the people and non-human animals that are involved in getting the food on our plate to our mouths.
Yes, indeed. Can I ask you about how long we'll be talking, and just remind me the venue. Is it taped or live?
Yes, okay, so we are live, and you are speaking with me, Karen Hartglass. The program is called It's All About Food, and this is with the Progressive Radio Network.
Okay.
And the program is an hour, but this interview will be 20 to 25 minutes, or right, as much time as you'd like to give us.
Okay. So folks are listening to us as we speak, are they?
Yes, it's live.
Okay, I didn't realize that. Okay.
Yes. Well. And I like to say tune in live and tune in love. That's what we do during this program.
Very nice.
I imagine that you are extremely busy today because your new book, What a Fish Knows, was released today. Congratulations.
Thank you. It's nice to, after 4 years of work, it's nice to have it finally actually out in the, fully in the public eye.
Now, just so my listeners know, Jonathan Balcombe is my guest, and he's the director of Animal Sentience at the Humane Society Institute for Science and Policy, and the author of 4 previous books, including Second Nature and Pleasurable Kingdom, and he has a website, jonathanbalcombe.com. And you can follow him at Twitter at Pumilla66, PUMILLA66. I've read your book, and it's been an absolute pleasure to read it. Every page brings magic and wonder, and really exposes us to the greater, it's like there's another universe here on our own planet, which is the ocean, something we know so little about and we're just starting to discover. And you've shared so much of the little that we know today about the life underwater.
Well, I can tell you, Karen, one of the delights of writing this book was the discoveries that came along the way. I wrote the book for two primary reasons. One of the key reasons was that there's so much great science on fish's inner lives now, but most of it never makes it into the public eye. It's buried away in scholarly journals. And once I started working on it, there were just so many more discoveries as I went along that it was very exciting to discover a new study of individual recognition or social behavior or sexual behavior or personalities in fishes, and know that I would be able to work that into my book and that I was going to be putting together something that people could see and just hopefully just open their eyes and realize just how rich these animals' lives are and how we've underestimated them.
Well, let's put the idea of eating fish aside for a moment. I want you to know I am vegan and I promote a plant-based diet, and we talk about eating non-human animals and what that does to the planet all the time on this program. But putting that aside, why is it that a lot of this research has been unheard of and doesn't get a lot of media attention? Because I really think people would love to hear this information. It's fascinating.
Well, I guess it sort of works in my favor that it has been shrouded in a bit of mystery. It's a great question, and I don't have an immediate answer because the press, certainly these days, you see more and more really cool animal stuff in the news. I mean, I can mention two studies that have come across my desk in the last week on fishes themselves. One is a couple of days ago, I saw a new published study, which is pretty sad and tragic, that farmed salmon become severely depressed. Mm. It's very common. There's these dropout fish. They sort of give up. They just float to the surface and they're listless and they don't eat and the other fishes are like three times as big, and they basically wither and die. And the scientists measured the cortisol levels in these fishes. That's a hormone associated with stress, and you could say misery. And the cortisol levels were way higher in these dropouts, apparently depressed fish. They showed all the hallmarks behaviorally and physiologically of what we would define as depression in mammals. And I do write about emotions in the book. And so anyway, that's one study. The other study that just came to light just today is a new study of archer fishes, which are really cool, and I dedicate several pages of my book to them. They're called archer fishes because they hunt they catch food in the water, but they also, if the opportunity arises, they'll squirt water out of their mouths into the air and actually pick off flying insects or insects perched on a leaf with great accuracy. And they learn this by observing other fishes doing this. So it's pretty remarkable. But they've just been found to recognize human faces. It frankly doesn't surprise me, Karen, that they can do this because, as I describe in my book, fishes are very good at recognizing individuals in their society. They have their shoal mates. They have their preferred individuals to hang out with. They're very visual in many cases. And so not surprisingly to me that they can recognize a human face and distinguish that face from another human face.
There are too many things that we have assumed as humans, that we have assumed as we think being the most intelligent things around, that other living species cannot do all the wonderful things that we can do. And it's really a very ignorant assumption and an arrogant assumption. And every page in your book talks about the amazing things that we've taken for granted about the life underwater. You just mentioned recognizing faces. You've shown, and the studies have shown, that fish can recognize their own, their community, as well as when they're in a tank, they can recognize some of us. I've just been fascinated by this book. And the fact that fish use tools.
Do you want me to elaborate on that?
I would love you to, because that's one of the things that's been exploding these days with land animals using tools, because that was supposed to be the evidence that we were so superior to everything.
I wonder, Pricey, that by just saying that absolutely there's a huge amount to celebrate about humans. I mean, we are a remarkable species. We have a number of characteristics that I think are fairly unique to us. But we have to realize that other creatures also have their wonderful characteristics, and they also have their uniquenesses, if you like. In fact, I think we should celebrate the fact that fishes are so vastly different from us, and yet they are cousins. I deliberately use the word cousins in the subtitle of the book to provoke, but also to remind readers that they are members of the vertebrate clan. They are direct links to us. I was about to say ancestors. I actually don't like that word because evolution is ongoing. It's not as if fishes stopped evolving when the first lobe fins, ancestor of mammals and birds and terrestrial animals, crawled out of the water a couple of hundred million years ago. No, they've continued to evolve and flourish. And in fact, we are in an age of fishes. The age of mammals is long past. The fishes are the ones who are the most diverse today. But let me speak about tool use. It's something that we don't generally associate with fishes, and I try to present a number of things in the book that might raise eyebrows when you consider that fishes actually can do these things. But fishes have the disadvantages of not having grasping limbs and fingers and such, and so they're limited in the kinds of tool use they might be able to express. But in fact, they can use their mouths. They can also blow water I already mentioned the archer fishes. They can blow water with their mouths, shoot water out of their mouths, and catch things. That's a form of tool use. But they can also push water with their mouths or gills, and they can uncover mollusks that way. So an example of tool use would be a triggerfish or a wrasse, and there's some other species, tusk fishes, who will deliberately blow water either with their mouths or their gill covers to uncover the sand and uncover a mollusk, and then pick the animal up with their mouths and then swim very deliberately to a rock that they will use as an anvil to, with a series of well-coordinated, well-timed head flicks and releases, which is not easily done. They are able to smash the unfortunate mollusk against the rock and to get at the soft insides. And it's a very deliberate sort of behavior. You can watch YouTube videos of this, and it's been published. And there's other examples of tool use in fishes that are being published now. And it seems to involve planning. I present it as such in the book, that the fish is actually thinking ahead, knows exactly what he or she is doing, knows the ultimate goal, but there are several steps to get there. And so it's more than just tool use. It's planning and wherewithal and awareness and consciousness and all those other things that we often forget that fishes have.
What I learned in your book about community, or all of the cultures that are going on underwater and how the fish interact with their same species and different species, it was all wonderful to read, but at the same time, I was a little frustrated to know that the same negative traits that we have in our own human communities, you can see them underwater as well. There's positive traits and not so positive traits.
Indeed, and that's, I think, another part of the beauty of the lives of fishes is that they are mirrors to us and vice versa. They are fallible. They fall for the same kinds of optical illusions that we do, for instance, and I present some of those in the book. They are sometimes mean to each other. There's certainly predation that goes on. I do like to, having written a couple of books on animal pleasure, I do also often like to see animal behavior through a pleasurable lens, and there's plenty of that. And I do describe, for instance, cleaning stations on reefs where client fishes line up to wait their turn to be serviced by cleaners of various species who pluck over them, removing parasites and sloughing skin and algae and that sort of thing. And it's a classic mutualism. The cleaner gets some food, and the client fish gets a spa treatment, and they appear to love it. They sometimes change color. They will pause while the cleaner fish takes a break from cleaning and actually just gratuitously gives them some caresses with their pectoral fins, which probably feels good. And they're not doing that for nothing, because they want to curry favor with the clients, because they want those clients to come back. And so there's clear behaviors that are built on the capacity to feel pleasure. But as you said in your question, I mean, it's Machiavellian under there. In fact, the cleaner's client relationship is complicated because you get cheaters, you get cleaners who do not such a good job, and careful studies have shown that cleaners are very well aware of who's watching them and how many other potential clients are watching them. And just as you might expect a better service from, say, a barber who has a number of people waiting for to be getting a haircut later, then if there's no one there watching or waiting, you get better treatment from cleaner fishes when they're being watched by clients. And why is that? Well, clients are actually forming image scores and keeping accounts of the cleaner's performance. I'm not making any of this up. It's all described in published literature. And because they can go somewhere else. They can go to a different cleaner. And so cleaners are more likely to nip off a little mote of mucus from the client if no one's watching them, because there's less of a cost, because they're not going to lose potential future clients if there's no audience. So this is the kind of Machiavellianism, and that's the term that a biologist used, another biologist in one of his papers, that I thought was a very appropriate term. It's there's pluses and minuses, there's awareness of others, there's reputations at stake, and not everybody always behaves well.
Now, a lot of this information has come from studying fishes in ways that cause them harm or cause them pain. And there's some sort of, I don't want to use the word balance, but we learn a lot, but at the same time, it's quite cruel.
Yeah, I often get asked by audience members when I speak about animals that people ask me, you know, I notice you cite some studies that are not very nice. And my response to that is, indeed, I wouldn't really be keen to do those studies myself. In fact, I'm a co-editor of a new journal called Animal Sentience, in which we encourage authors to be mindful of not harming animals in their studies and using positive reinforcement and rewards rather than punishment like starvation to motivate behaviors and that sort of thing, and to release animals back in the wild if they took them captive, but preferably to observe them in the wild, this sort of thing. But nevertheless, given that other people have taken pains to do studies and they've caused some fishes to suffer or even die in some cases, I feel that it honors the fishes more, and if I bring those studies to light, not as an endorsement, but to hopefully use the information gleaned from those studies to advance the cause, so that in future we'll have a more enlightened view of these creatures and be less inclined to do harmful things to them. So it's a little bit, it's a bit tricky, but that's just my view. It's kind of a utilitarian view in that case, but there's a lot of studies that I also cite that are not harmful, and the people who did the study went to lengths to make sure they didn't harm the fishes, and a growing number of scientists now report that they are returning their creatures back to the wild, and I'm very impressed to see that, because I can tell you that's still a rarity in science that they even report on it, whether they do it or not.
Well, the analogy is doing tests on non-human land animals and then using that information to understand human health and all issues around humans as well. And there's that question of whether to use that information or not. And many people do because it's available. Not that we necessarily, some of us, encourage that sort of thing.
Yes.
Okay, so how can we study what's going on underwater without harming the life there? What are there some organizations that are doing that?
There's a new organization called Fish Feel.
Just talked to Mary Finelli a few weeks ago.
Good, yeah. So it's nice to see that. There's some organizations in Europe that are working to try to change laws about fishes, and particularly in reference to commercial fishing, which is something that's going to be going on for some time yet, but it's deeply disturbing what is done to the animals who are caught in that industry. So, and also the fish farming, the aquaculture, which has been the fastest growing food production sector on the planet for the last number of years. And there are changes in some practices going on. These are very much welfare reforms. We're not talking about someone acknowledging that fishes have rights and that they deserve to be left alone or not exploited at all. Nevertheless, I do believe in an imperfect world that we need to work for changes on all fronts at all times. And so welfare changes are better than no changes at all, in my books. So it's important that we keep plugging ahead. And one of the things I try to do in the book is I juxtapose the science of what we now know that reveals these creatures as individuals with rich lives, with not just biology but biographies, and juxtapose that with the really, frankly, appalling treatment that we mete out on them, not because we're cruel, but because we're indifferent in the production of commercial fishing and recreational fishing in many cases. It's not nice the way we treat them. It's really nasty. Being hooked through the face, often through the eye, inadvertently, and then hauled up by your own body weight to the surface, and then, you know, depending on what situation is, worse things happening to you after that. It's pretty awful. If we were doing that to mammals on land, there would be, quite an outcry. And, of course, at our worst, we do horrible things to mammals as well. In any event, it's my hope that people will see that these animals are aware, they're alert, they're individuals, they have personalities, they have lives worth living for them. And that because of that, we have to start including them in our circle of moral concern. We must, because we're a moral creature, we're stuck with that. We have a sense of ethics. We know what right and wrong is. And right now, the way we treat them is wrong. And so we need to take that into consideration in our future behavior.
I'm not exactly sure how to describe how you do it, but with your writing, you make this horrible information very readable.
It has to be. You know, if people are disgusted or put off, they're going to put the book down and they're going to go no further. I mean, I can't speak for everybody. We're a very mixed bag. Mm-hmm. So just as the fishes are a very mixed bag, so are we. But I want to reach as many people as I can, and it's important that there be levity. It's important there be joy in the reading. And, of course, if you're writing about the way we treat fishes in commercial fishing, it isn't exactly joyous, but I try to keep it flowing and tell stories as well as relate the science, because people have to be motivated to want to change. This world is a wonderful world, and we have to make it better. And it's not about, oh, it's all so horrible and let's just throw our hands up and give up. It's about we can do so much better, and we've shown that we can do that in the past. And so that's why it's so important to keep a positive outlook on this stuff.
You mentioned the movie Finding Nemo a number of times in the book, and you do have a lot of humor in the book, which I enjoyed very much. I love this film, Finding Nemo, and one of my favorite lines in the film is, "Fish are your friends, not food." Are there some things that are beneficial from this film? You mentioned a number of times that they took a lot of liberties, but somehow I think just being able to see, even though it's a cartoon, the possibility that the life under the water can work together helps us understand that a little more.
Yeah, it's a great question. I've seen the film, and this book is strategically timed to coincide with the release of the sequel, Finding Dory, which is coming out in about 10 days' time. And, you know, I like to think that that these films can improve our attitudes towards, in this case, fishes. Of course, there are harms as well. There's already a campaign with Humane Society International and Tank Watch, for instance, to encourage people or discourage them from going and actually finding dory, which is to say going to a pet shop and buying blue tangs, which are featured in the film, because blue tangs are very vulnerable in their natural habitats. So that most of them are in the aquarium trade are taken from the wild. And it's grim. The aquarium trade, there's a lot of mortality. The shipment conditions are often terrible. The conditions, the methods they catch them are really bad. So that's the negative side. But I do like to think that these films also, because they personalize fishes so much, that in juxtaposition with, say, hopefully with my book, that people can see that actually they are actually quite a bit like us in many ways. And in a vacuum, they may not make that connection, but with the sort of information that I hope people will get from the book, those who actually read the book and watch the film that they will, that the film actually will help to advance attitudes and make people more sensitive and concerned with these creatures?
Other than reading your book, which I think everyone should do, honestly, what can people be doing now to help underwater life, which really affects all life? Because without them, we can't survive either.
Yeah, well, I think it's important to meet people where they are and to get them moving forward. So if people are, say, pescatarians, they're vegetarians, but except that they still eat fishes, which are definitely animals, stop eating fishes would be a great step. If they are fishermen, then consider stopping fishing or taking up bird watching. Or if you're going to keep fishing, replace your barbed hooks with barbless hooks, or take your barbed hooks and crimp them with a pliers, set of pliers, so that they are no longer barbed. So there are steps anywhere along the spectrum that people can take to make things better for fishes.
Well, Jonathan Balcombe, thank you for joining me on It's All About Food and for writing this book, What a Fish Knows, The Inner Lives of Our Underwater Cousins. Congratulations on your release of this book.
And thanks for having me, Karen.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, well, you know, I read a lot of books on this program, and sometimes I interview authors after reading their book, and I don't say a lot about it. I'm going to say that this one is one of my favorites, and I really recommend going out and reading it. It's a lovely, lovely read. All right, let's move over to my next guest, because she is with us, I understand, Erin Orr, and she's a chef, storyteller, puppeteer, and educator based in Brooklyn. She endeavors to create experiences that encourage and foster community, whether they are crafted from food, with words, or via visual spectacle. She maintains the food blog Big Sis Little Dish, where she shares original, adapted, and passed on recipes and stories about the memories and gatherings connected to them. She's currently executive chef for Cynthia Von Bueller's immersive theater excursion, The Illuminati Ball, and she's assembled an 8-course vegan tasting menu that guests of the ongoing event series continue to concur is both delicious and satisfying. Erin, how are you today?
I'm well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm sorry that I wasn't able to meet you live in the studio today, but I'm spending a bit of time out west in California, so we have to use cyberspace to connect.
Okay.
And, you know, I almost had a problem because we had a power outage here earlier today.
Oh, no.
I always like to bring up something I'm grateful for on this program. And today I'm grateful for electricity.
Yes.
When you have it, you have to get very creative when you don't, because so much of our lives today are built on technology that
utterly
uses
dependent
electrical power.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, I mean, even cooking. You can cook with fire. But many
of
them
cook. You can cook without electricity, but you do need to have a number of things in place that most of us don't in our current urban existence.
Exactly. Yeah. Or you can just go all raw. But even with the high-end raw foods, many raw food chefs are dependent on all those crazy tools, right?
Yeah, it's true.
Yes. All right. So Nell Auk, a friend of mine, mentioned the Illuminati Ball. And it sounded very mysterious to a point where I wasn't even sure what it was.
Yeah, but it is intended to be a little bit mysterious, so I hope that we can illuminate it a little bit, but not too much, before the conversation is out.
Illuminate the Illuminati Ball.
Exactly. it's an immersive theater excursion, so it's definitely not a typical, you know, sit down in a theater and passively receive a story as an audience member sort of experience. The participants are very active within the event. And the event includes a very lavish 8-course meal and very beautiful cocktails, as well as a trip to a secret estate outside of the city. So it's not in a theater. It's in a very beautiful home on beautiful grounds. It's an unusual setting for this kind of thing.
Mm. And you've had how many so far? Because I know they're ongoing this summer.
Yes, I think we've done 7 or 8 at this point. Mm. We're doing them more or less twice a month, and we'll be continuing on through the end of the summer. Yes, at least.
Yes, and I imagine since it's somewhat interactive, my understanding with the participants that not every event is the same.
I do believe that they vary. I don't know a whole lot about exactly what all happens during the show because I am in the kitchen the whole time.
Of course.
I sort of hear about it afterward, about different groups of people have different reactions or levels of interactivity depending on how timid or gung-ho they are to really participate. So it's not the sort of thing where you're going to be forced to do anything you don't want to do. It's you very much get to decide how you participate in the piece. And some audiences are extremely involved and others hang back more, and then sometimes there's a mix. But the story of the piece overall remains the same. It's just what people discover within the story, I think, varies depending on how they participate within it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now let's step back a little bit and talk about you. And you have your food blog, Big Sis Little Dish, and you have your own food story.
Yes, as everyone does.
Yeah, so please share a little bit of that with us.
The food blog was started actually by my sister, hence the name, Big Sis Little Dish. She's 12 years younger than I am, and she used to come live with me fairly often for little spurts of time, and we get to cook together and be together. And, now she's an adult. She has her own life in Vancouver, Canada, and can't just come and live with me for months at a time. And she had this idea that we could have a food blog where we basically just wrote about whatever we were cooking. So it really started out as a way to continue cooking together across a very long distance. It wasn't intended necessarily for public consumption. So it started out, between the two of us and our family members and friends, and has sort of grown from there. And actually, Sylvie doesn't post to the – Sylvie is my sister. She doesn't post to the blog very often anymore. She was cooking professionally in a chocolate shop, a gourmet chocolatier for a while, and I think was not as excited about coming home and writing out recipes. And also she has, the way she's eaten has changed a lot over these years. She has become vegetarian and then vegan. And I, for health reasons, have to eat gluten-free. So there's a kind of wild variety of recipes on the blog that span all the ways that she and I have eaten over the last 5 or 6 years. Because it really is about how we eat, how we share food, how we make sure that even if we're needing to eat certain ways or choosing to eat certain ways, that we're all sort of having that community together. So even though Sylvie doesn't post anymore, I still think of it the same way, I guess.
We have, for my nonprofit, Responsible Eating and Living, we have a blog called What Vegans Eat. It's a daily blog, and we're now
crowd sharing how people are doing their eating, yes.
All it is really is I post what my partner Gary and I eat every day, and it came out of the fact that as a vegan, people so often ask, what do you eat? And I just direct them to the blog now because it's all right there. Nothing special about it. It's just what I eat. But what was fun and I thought was a little bit like what you've done with your sister is occasionally when I'm apart from Gary, which isn't too often, I do the blog and then I hand it over to him and he does his part about what he's been eating while he's away, while I'm away. And I've just found it fun to do that. just between he and I, but it's open to anybody who wants to read the blog as well.
And I imagine it's probably a really great resource for people who are feeling intimidated about that as they're transitioning into eating that way, to be able to look at how people are feeding themselves over a long period of time in a satisfying and successful way. That's, making any kind of dietary choice that you're making it sustainable and really doable is a huge part of it. Yeah.
Yeah. So we do have some very fancy, sophisticated, complicated recipes on our website, but in the blog, I don't want to say that it's boring, but there's a lot of foods that we eat that repeat over and over during the week that we enjoy, that we find easy, that's satisfying. And so people can just see how doable it is.
Yes.
All right. So you were asked to provide the tasting menu for this event, and you're not vegan, but you made this menu. So was that a learning experience, or had you already moved into this area of vegan food?
A little bit of both. It's certainly been a learning experience. Absolutely. It's a huge menu. 8 courses is a lot to provide in a way that really all works together as a, as a complete arc, as a work of art unto itself. There are a lot of bits and pieces that go into it that have to all balance out. The vegan aspect, because my sister is vegan and because my mother, doesn't eat eggs or dairy for health reasons or gluten, and probably truthfully eventually I will have to give up eggs and dairy as well. because I can sort of look at the people in my family and what they're dealing with health wise and sort of predict my future if I'm utterly reasonable about it. And particularly in the summers when I go home to visit my family, We're pretty much eating vegan because that's what everybody can have together. And I enjoy making vegan food. It's a whole other, alchemical challenge. Because part of my interest in cooking is the alchemy aspect of how to transform ingredients in various ways, what they can do or, what they can make that's surprising. That's really interesting to me. And, it's been wonderful to have an excuse to, during the year, actually play more with that kind of food alchemy with vegan food and discover more about it. So some of the things that I've put on the menu for the Illuminati Ball are things that I have made for my family that I know are really delicious and wonderful, and I'm making them, I'm plating them very beautifully and making them a little fancier than I would for home food, obviously, because the goal is to really have a very luxurious and decadent experience. But I started with some things that I knew were good, that people would love. And then there have been other things that I've really had to learn how to make. That most notably, there's a very beautiful yuba dish that's based on a traditional Chinese sort of mock duck dish. I've never really been a giant fan of foods that try to emulate meat. I don't know. I think there's a lot of amazing food in the world, and that if you don't want to eat meat, there's plenty of delicious, incredible flavors to choose from. And I've never been super interested in fake meat myself. Partially also because I have all of these health issues around gluten and other mystery ingredients, and fake meat can get very complicated, in terms of getting the ingredient list. I find that totally not what my body wants. But I have to say, this very traditional Chinese yuba duck is wonderful. It's such a beautiful, elegant, interesting dish. It has an incredible texture and incredible set of flavors, and it is not easy to make. That would be in the category of complicated, very, very complicated vegan dishes, but well worth it if you want to make something really spectacular for guests or for a special occasion.
You posted all of these items on your blog, and I was looking at the pictures, and that's definitely my favorite. I love yuba, which is also called bean curd skin. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, you're in an area where purchasing bean curd skin is an easy thing to do.
Yes, it's not easy everywhere. And it's also there, yuba can come in different forms. You can buy it more easily in dry sheets, but often those sheets are crumbled, which makes it kind of useless to work with as an ingredient, unfortunately. But if you can find a source for the frozen sheets that are still, when you thaw them, they're still damp and pliable, that's an incredible ingredient to work with. And here in New York, obviously, we have several large Asian shopping areas where you can get frozen, huge, big round sheets of frozen yuba. One of the things I love about yuba is that it's this incredibly thrifty ingredient. It's basically, it's a byproduct of making soy milk. So you can sort of imagine how they were making this wonderful milky substance from soybeans, and just as with any milk, when you heat it up, it makes this skin across the top, and they removed the skin and were thrifty enough and resourceful enough to decide to see what would happen if they laid it out to dry, and invented this incredible, simple, clean, wonderful.
I remember when I was a little girl and I would make pudding or something with cow's milk, cause I did consume that back when I was young. And, when I would get the skin on top, it would just freak me out. I thought it was disgusting.
It is kind of scary.
Yeah, but the soybean skin, I think it's a beautiful thing. I love it when it's seasoned properly and prepared. So I was excited to see that dish. Yeah. Now, I'm wondering, did you use any websites or recipe books for resources? We live in a time right now where it's easier than ever to prepare vegan foods. And there's so much information and resources that are free, accessible online to do just about anything. And I'm just curious what path you took.
Well, I do read a lot of food blogs. So a number of the sort of fancier, trickier vegan things that I include on the menu, the ideas came from things I had read on other people's food blogs when I was, reading around, like how to make cashew cream or to make really, really delicious frozen, almost ice cream-like desserts from cashews. I actually have a really amazing Chinese cookbook that I've had for years that I used as the main source for how to do the yuba duck. Although all of the recipes for the Illuminati ball, at least, were sort of adjusted. But one that isn't, my favorite blog source for vegan food is actually, the blog My New Roots, which you're probably familiar with. But it's a spectacular collection of recipes written by a woman with an immense amount of knowledge about nutrition that she shares as part of her posts. And there's beautiful, beautiful photographs. And the seed and nut bread recipe that I make for the table is actually a recipe directly from her blog. I find that to be a really good source.
So let me ask you, some of my favorite ingredients to make incredible things come from the simple chickpea. Using chickpea flour, garbanzo bean flour, is just crazy what it can do.
It's amazing. It is amazing.
And it's gluten-free.
And it makes chickpea flour makes some of the most wonderful cake texture. It's a really good flour, a gluten-free flour for making cakes. Some people don't like detecting the chickpea flavor in their baked goods, and that's one of the pitfalls of using chickpea flour, for desserts at least. But I find if you're seasoning it with cocoa powder or extracts lemon, any kind of strong flavoring in the dessert, and you don't detect the bean flavor at all. I actually just made chickpea brine meringues for the first time last week.
That was my next question. Aquafaba, aquafaba.
Craze for aquafaba. I need to play with it more. They turned out delicious. They were fantastic. They weren't exactly like meringues, but they were delicious. And I guess something I should say about the Illuminati ball is that obviously we're talking very openly about the fact that the menu is vegan, but it's not actually advertised that way. The people who buy tickets to the Illuminati ball, it doesn't say anywhere that it's a vegan meal. They know that they're getting a sumptuous, delicious, multi-course meal, but we don't go into any details. We ask them what their allergies are, so they know that they're not going to be fed anything that will hurt them. But it's actually not revealed. I think many of the diners won't totally register that it's a vegan meal until they receive the thank you email after the show from Cynthia with the link to the recipes.
And that leads me to two questions. So the first question is, do some of the participants figure out that they're not going to be served animals, and what is their reaction to that?
Well, it's actually part of the action of the piece. The question of consuming meat and many other moral questions come up in the content of the show. So it becomes a conversation in the piece intentionally. So some attention is drawn to the fact that there have been a lot of vegetables at some point in the meal. So certainly some people are aware of it. But when we bring out the duck, sometimes there's arguments about whether it's duck or not. It's interesting. To tie that back to the aquafaba argument, I probably wouldn't offer aquafaba meringues until I got a better handle on how to really do them so that they could pass as meringues that somebody who's been eating egg white meringues recently would, you know?
Sure.
Not necessarily.
It's definitely doable, though.
I think it is doable. I just have to play around with it a bit more. Part of the goal of this piece is that there's a bit of subtle, not so subtle even, activism happening with this piece where, you know, there's a perception that in order to have a really luxurious experience, the suffering of animals needs to be involved. that's a cultural perception. People wouldn't necessarily voice it in quite those terms, but it's underlying their assumptions about what makes something luxurious or not. And part of what I'm trying to do dramaturgically for this meal is really create a truly decadent, luxurious, beautiful meal that meets satisfies the needs and the palate of somebody who has eaten meat recently, you know, so that when they do discover or realize that the meal is vegan, it can sort of get them to question that underlying assumption.
Yeah, this is a very important point, and it's the part of our culture that definitely needs to change. And unfortunately, this culture is spread all around the world globally, so that communities that have been poor, in poverty, and are suddenly realizing new affluence, they want to include more animal foods in their diet, and it's not good for their health, it's not good for the environment, and it's not good for the animals.
Yeah.
So we need to make this change, and it's so easy. Well, I think maybe easy is not the right word, but it's definitely doable, and more people need to experience the luxurious, delicious foods that are made from plant ingredients. I had interviewed a couple of people who ran a bed and breakfast in Mendocino called the Stanford Inn, and they've had it for decades, and they were talking about how when they were moving to make it all vegan, how some of their clients were complaining. And so this event that you're doing, the Illuminati Ball, it's expensive.
It is. It's expensive. I mean, if you think about the fact that you get an 8-course meal and several really incredibly beautifully crafted cocktails. They are serious. The bartender, our mixologist, Bootleg Greg, is an artist. Mm. And then there is a whole theatrical experience with aerial work and opera and burlesque and incredible handcrafted masks that people are wearing, the participants as well as the actors, and access to this really beautiful piece of property and a trip out of the city. If you sort of add all of that stuff together, it isn't such a crazy ticket price, really.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still more than, for example, I could afford to spend on an evening. You know, I wouldn't be able to do it myself. So the people who are able to come are people who spend money on luxury experiences. Yeah.
Yeah. The reason why I brought it up that it's expensive is that often, as you mentioned, when people are going to an event that's high-end, they're expecting a luxurious meal, and that, in their mind, equals animal foods.
Yes,
and
it does.
That's not true.
It doesn't have to. And that's been a really fun challenge to work on that. I was also, I have to say too, I went for a tasting menu just to sort of get a sense of how these meals are typically sort of formed, what the structure of the meal should be. And one of the things, and I went to a very, you know, reputable, famous place. I'm not going to mention it by name, but, and it was good, but I did not feel well after the meal. And part of it was that the meal actually had a lot of dairy in it, like really more dairy than, you know, even if I hadn't ended up with an upset stomach, they were too reliant on dairy. There needed to be more variety, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it was that when you're doing little tiny plates, there's an urge to really sock in the flavor because people are only getting a few bites. And sometimes that socking in a flavor translates to a lot of salt. But at the end of the meal, once you've eaten all those little bites and all those courses, you've still eaten all that salt.
Right.
So I've tried to be also conscious of making sure that people will feel good afterward, you know, they'll wake up the next day feeling like they ate real food. And I think that's rare in a luxury experience. I think frequently we're so excited to have this luxury experience, and then it actually makes our bodies feel horrible. It's not really food that's that good for people. So, you know,
it can go one way or another. People can feel horrible, or they can feel really hungry afterwards.
Or really hungry. That would be awful, too. Gosh, that would be terrible. That would make me so sad. Yeah.
Yeah.
I hope people feel satisfied. I'm sure they do.
Okay. So where can people find out about the Illuminati Ball?
There is a website. I'm going to make sure I say it the right way before I say it online. So there is, I'm finding it. You can buy tickets at theilluminatiball.com.
Oh, there we go. Easy enough.
That's what I had in my mind, and then I thought it sounded too simple, but it really is just that, theilluminatiball.com. Mm-hmm. That is where the tickets are available. And we've talked a lot about the food, but the ball, the food is really just one aspect of the whole experience. It really is visually and sensually extremely beautiful and worthwhile, I feel.
Yeah, and for people that might be more curious about it, you can just Google Illuminati Ball, and a number of reviews have come up. You can get teasers with photographs of what's going on and some very brief descriptions that might give you more of a clue of what's happening at these events. That's what I did.
Yes, but for your listeners, know that although we don't mention the vegan menu anywhere in the mainstream press or on the website, it is an entirely vegan meal.
And gluten-free.
And gluten-free, because I have to be able to eat the food to taste it to make sure it tastes good.
Well, you know, I think a vegan gluten-free meal is great because it appeals to the least common denominator. Pretty much everybody can eat that. And there's
pretty
still some people that have some... Some people might have, you know, some nut allergies, some soy allergies.
Yes.
But
every show we have someone who has nut allergies. They're fairly common. And we make changes to their plate to make sure that they're not receiving any food that will make them sick. We accommodate that. They just have to answer. There's a questionnaire process involved in buying the tickets. And have to actually let us know in advance. It's not, the food is not coming from a big catering service or a restaurant. It's, you know, me and my assistant in the kitchen of a house. So you have to actually answer the questionnaire and let us know what you can and can't eat. And we're happy to accommodate you. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that sounds pretty tasty. Sounds pretty magical. Erin Orr, thank you for joining me on It's All About Food today.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. And I will check out your blog, especially that yerba duck thing that looks so tasty. Okay, we have like a minute and a half left, and I was planning on talking about a number of things, and if I'm going to do that, I'm going to have to talk fairly fast because I don't have any more time. There is an organization called what are they called? Their website is WRI.org. They are a global resource or research organization, and they have been putting out, it's called the World Resources Institute, and they've been putting out these reports on sustainable diets, and they have one that just came out. And what I like about it is they have some really great graphs. You might check them out if you want to share them with people about the impact of different foods on the environment. And they show that meat, of course, is so unsustainable in terms of the energy and the water and the calories required to put in to an animal to get the calories out. And then there are some amusing things that I've found on their blog, because people are still afraid to just come out and say, go vegan already. They're still being gentle and saying, you don't have to be vegan or vegetarian, you just have to eat more plants. And I will have to confess that that is probably a good message. We all need to be eating more plants. If you don't want to be giving up meat and dairy, you can eat a lot less. And so you might check out WRI.org and download their report and get some of these cool graphs that you can share if you're into doing some advocacy and activism. Okay, you've been listening to It's All About Food, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. Thank you for joining me today. And remember, have a delicious week.